Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this, the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas, for our second weekend of Einstein Fest. This afternoon's lecture will be slightly different from previous lectures for those who have had the pleasure of attending some of our lectures earlier in the festival. It will be different for two reasons. First of all, I'd like to spend a few moments to welcome a special guest who's here this afternoon. And second of all, as you know, the lecture today will be in two parts. We will have two speakers, one who will speak for 15 minutes and one who will speak for 45 minutes. So the format of today's lecture is that I will introduce our special guest, then I will have the opportunity, after she says a few words, to introduce both of the speakers. So now let me turn to the first item on the agenda. Many of you have had the opportunity to come to previous lectures already during our Young Festival. It's only a week old. For those who have had the opportunity of planning it and attending many of the events, it might seem a little bit longer than that. But nonetheless, we're tremendously pleased and tremendously proud of not only what we've been able to accomplish, but your involvement in enabling us to reach the heights and aspire to the heights that we are, in fact, aspiring to. That is, to have nothing less than an international leading outreach effort of the highest possible international level. Now, this festival is one which not only takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication and a lot of determination from staff at the Institute, the volunteers you see around you, and everyone in the community to support it. It also takes financial support. And it also takes leadership to pledge financial support of the order that we need, that we require, to do something at the highest international level. Now, this afternoon, we're very fortunate to have Beth Horowitz with us, and Beth is the president of American Express Canada. American Express is the lead sponsor of this festival, and I can assure you that without their support, we would be nowhere able to produce the type of programming that we have produced for you during this festival. It is absolutely paramount that we have players of the caliber, of the largesse, and of the vision that American Express has shown to stake their reputation through their philanthropic program with a fledgling institute such as ourselves. It is only through the partnership of institutions such as ourselves and American Express that we will be able to attain the heights that we are so fervently aspiring to. And now I would like to introduce Beth Horowitz to say a few words. Beth.
Thanks very much, Howard. I'm really delighted to be here today, and I look forward to the lecture, as I know all of you do, so I will be brief. American Express is very proud to be presenting sponsor of Einstein Fest. We were first introduced to the Perimeter Institute through our relationship with Mike Lazaridis as part of our My Life, My Card campaign. And we actually shot our print ad as well as part of the TV ad right here at the Institute. The Perimeter Institute is world-renowned. I think Howard was being a bit modest. World-renowned and a Canadian jewel. And one we really discovered, once we really discovered the Institute through working with Mike on the ad, and we heard about Einstein Fest, we immediately saw the potential and wanted to get involved. Art and cultural heritage is an area of major focus for the American Express Foundation. And we saw this festival as a fascinating way to explore scientific advancement, as well as its relationship to and inspiration for the arts. Through a multifaceted series of events and exciting programming, the world of scientific breakthrough is opened up to the public. We love the fact that Einstein Fest celebrates innovation and engages the community at the same time, opening the Institute's doors to those interested in science, to school groups, and to those attracted by the performers and showcase events. Einstein Fest is educational, informative, and enlightening, and at the same time, accessible, entertaining, and fun. and American Express is proud to be presenting sponsor. So please enjoy yourselves this afternoon. Thank you, and back to you, Howard.
Thank you very, very much, Beth. I would now like to give a formal introduction to both of our speakers. Robert Friedel will talk first, as I mentioned, for 15 minutes, followed by Mike Lazaridis. So I will introduce both of them, and then I will ask Robert to come up and take the stage. Many of you have had the opportunity of hearing Robert's talk this morning, which was, in my view, an exceptionally stimulating and enlightening overview of technological change occurring in 1905 and its impact on our generation. Robert is a professor of history of technology, history of science, and environmental history at the University of Maryland. He has written several monographs in the history of technology, focusing largely on the nature of invention. And in addition, he has published numerous articles and shorter works on material culture, as well as the history of technology, ranging from the history of materials to changes in the engineering profession. Before coming to the University of Maryland, he was a historian at the Smithsonian Institute and the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. He continues extensive work with museums, consulting and collaborating in a range of projects for museums and agencies in Calcutta, Delhi, Stockholm, Munich, and Pittsburgh, as well as Washington. His museum exhibits include A Material World at the National Museum of American History and Breakthrough, or rather Breaking Through, the Creative Engineer for the National Building Museum. He is active in numerous capacities for the Society for the History of Technology, has been a contributing editor for American Heritage of Invention and Technology since 1985, and an advisory editor for Technology and Culture since 1993. He has held fellowships at the Smithsonian, the Hagley Museum, the American Antiquarian Society, and the Dibner Institute for the History of Science and Technology. Professor Friedel received his PhD from the Johns Hopkins University in 1977. Mike Lazaridis is a difficult person for me to formally introduce because over the years we've had a very close relationship, and I count Mike among one of my closest friends. He is president and co-CEO of Research in Motion, a company he founded along with two colleagues while in his fourth year of an electrical engineering degree at the University of Waterloo back in 1984. From these relatively humble beginnings, RIM has become one of Canada's preeminent technology companies with offices in North America, Europe, and Asia Pacific, employs thousands of people, and the BlackBerry, which I'm sure I don't need to introduce to everybody here, has emerged as one of the most dominant global brands throughout the world in communication devices. At RIM, Mike is responsible for product strategy, research and development, product development and manufacturing. In addition to his leadership at RIM, Mike, with his wife Ophelia, have emerged as Canada's leading philanthropists by donating $100 million towards the establishment of this institute, Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, as well as a further $50 million to found the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. It is, of course, no coincidence that we are sitting today in the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas, not only as a testament to Mike's donation and investment, and as well as Ophelia's of financial resources, but also their combined investment of time and effort for this community and for the world. Mike participates in numerous government initiatives involving science and technology at the provincial and federal level, including sitting on NSER Council, as well as the recently convened Federal Task Force on Commercialization. In recognition of his leadership and innovation, he was named Canada's Nation Builder of the Year in 2002 by readers of the Globe and Mail. He holds an honorary Doctor of Engineering degree from the University of Waterloo, and in June 2003 was named the university's 8th Chancellor. Ladies and gentlemen, Drs. Robert Friedel and Mike Lazaridis.
I was asked to spend a few minutes to give you a little bit of a historical background of wireless communications. I wasn't quite sure where to do this or how to start. There is a degree, of course, to which wireless communications is something that's very ancient indeed. We communicate without wires from the moment that we are born, if you stop and think about it. And so when we stop to think about what we actually mean by wireless communication, we have to think a little bit more broadly than what you might have thought we were going to think about. So we have a question. How do we get from the screen to certain other forms of wireless communication? We begin to introduce technologies to enable wireless communication. The technologies need not be very sophisticated, right? But they, in fact, do work in terms of communicating over a distance. But as we move into the 19th and the 20th century, our dreams extend, our technological capabilities expand until we reach the 20th century world, in which case we now begin to get different notions of what might be possible in terms of wireless communication. I suppose this only appeals to those of us who are of a certain age who remember Maxwell Smart and his depiction of the possibilities of the shoe phone. That was probably my first exposure to what we think of now in a more modern sense of wireless communication. There are other ways in which we were introduced to this notion in one way or another. It's curious to think that Dick Tracy, of course, way back in the 1940s, used a wristwatch in order to communicate. This is obviously an updated version with his two-way wrist Mac. But the fact is that we have moved into a new world, of course, of communication. So what we're really moving toward is, you know, basically the cellular telephone and, of course, the possibilities extended to the BlackBerry itself. But how do we begin this story is really what we're going to ask about. I talked a little bit to Mike before preparing this talk, and actually I've been thinking along these lines anyway. So I have a sense that this is pretty much about where we both agree we should start. One of my great heroes is Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday was a remarkable individual. He was an Englishman living in the first half of the 19th century. He was a lecturer. Actually, the parallel between where he lectured at the Royal Institution and what the Perimeter Institute is doing are kind of interesting to contemplate, because he would stand before audiences and he would give lectures, and then he would go back into his own laboratory and give thought about the kind of physics that he was dealing with. And of course, Faraday is most important for us as historians for his investigations of electricity, although I might add it's not where he stopped. And in particular, his investigation of the magnet and of electromagnetism, of what did a magnet mean? What does it mean when a magnet moves? Now, in 1820, a predecessor of Faraday, by the name of Hans Oersted, discovered, in fact, that when you have an electrical current going through a wire, you produce a magnetic field. Now, this was something that we take for granted, but was actually a fairly startling discovery at the time. So people went to investigate what the meaning of this, the possibilities, and Faraday was one of the people who investigated this. And Faraday is probably most notable to us for having investigated the reverse phenomenon, which we call electromagnetic induction, which is to say that not only do we have a magnetic field being generated by an electrical current through a wire, but we can actually create an electrical current in a wire by moving a magnetic field, which is in fact what the induction effect of Faraday is. Now, when we Faraday was very much an experimental scientist. He loved tinkering in the laboratory. He loved envisioning. The kind of images that you see here are very representative of the way his mind worked. He worked in pictures. So, in fact, Faraday eschewed mathematics. He was not mathematical at all. He had no way of, in fact, mathematically enunciating or describing the sorts of insight that he had. So, in fact, there were many scientists in Europe at that time who basically scoffed at Faraday. They basically said, well, you know, it can't be terribly important because he can't put it into mathematical form. He can't formalize it. But one of the people who didn't scoff in a generation after Faraday was a great mathematician out of Scotland by the name of James Clerk Maxwell. And he took the ideas of Faraday, the notions about magnets, about lines of force, about what happens when you move a magnet and how these forces change. And he thought visually, but he also thought in terms of mathematics. He was one of the most brilliant mathematicians of the 19th century, and he made the indispensable translation of the kind of insight about electricity and magnetism that Faraday represented into mathematical form. And as many of you will fondly note, or perhaps not so fondly note, the upshot of all of this is a set of equations. Now, this simplified things a bit much, I'm afraid. But nonetheless, this is the way in which Maxwell attempted to sort of capture the basic insights of what happens when we have electromagnetic fields and what happens when electromagnetic fields change. That was what he was particularly interested in. And you'll notice that these equations are actually associated with discoveries of other individuals, Faraday, Ampere, Gauss, and then that famous fourth equation, which was sort of the extra insight that Maxwell added to the picture of what happened when we change electromagnetic field. Now, why is this relevant to our story? Well, it turns out that when we work through this mathematics, when we put in a few numbers in terms of what we know about the behavior of magnetic fields, one of the things that we discover is that when a magnetic field changes, that the effect of that magnetic field at a distance is not instantaneous. It, in fact, takes a certain amount of time. Now, it doesn't take much time. The effect is actually propagated at the speed of light, which is pretty fast, we all agree. And one of the implications of that fact is that Maxwell began to allow us to extend our vision of electromagnetism beyond the purely electromagnetic effect that we had seen before and to connect them to light itself. And in making that connection, Maxwell gives us a new picture of what light is. And it's a kind of combination of an electric wave and a magnetic wave in fields that are related, as you see here in this image. Now, another implication of all of this is that the light that we see around us is simply one form of electromagnetic radiation, which in fact is a very small portion of a much larger spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, which extends all the way through the radio spectrum, that is longer and longer and longer waves, to the other end, toward the cosmic rays and the gamma rays, which are shorter and shorter and shorter rays, more energetic, higher frequency, and the like. Now, all of this was unknown in Maxwell's day, and in fact, the very notion of electromagnetic radiation outside of the realm of light was a largely theoretical notion. It was something that people sort of scoffed at the possibilities. But at the same time, which is the 1860s, now moving into the 1870s, people are, in fact, beginning to think about ways in which they can extend the communication technologies that are coming out of the middle of the 19th century. The telegraph was introduced in the 1830s and the 1840s. Simple electrical signals sent over wires, usually received in form of code. But by the 1870s, scientists are beginning, and inventors are beginning to think about other ways of somewhat more sophisticated forms of communication. And one of those, of course, is Alexander Graham Bell, who introduces his telephone to the world in 1876. Well, one of the things that's quite interesting, many people don't know this, is that Bell, too, found the idea of wires to be somewhat limiting, the idea that maybe we could go beyond wires. So, in fact, Bell, in the 1880s, along with his cousin, began a set of experiments for the creation of what he calls the photophone, which is a way of taking the telephone signals and converting them into light, and then using a photodetector and the photoelectric effect, which Einstein later discovered and explained, was in fact something that was well known by that time. Particularly the reaction of the element selenium to light was something that Bell could apply. So he devises this device. It's not very practical at all, but it does tell us the idea of using the electromagnetic spectrum, at least in the form of light that we know, was something that people thought was worth pursuing. But as long as that electromagnetic spectrum was light itself, then you couldn't do much with it. And so that brings another hero of our tale, which is Heinrich Hertz, a young, ambitious German physicist who believed, unlike many of his colleagues, that the kind of radiation that Maxwell had described in his equation and that was implied by his equation, the long wave radiation, for example, or the very, very short wave radiation, were real, and that they could possibly be made, and they could be detected. And we see here the apparatus, or at least one depiction of the apparatus that Hertz, in fact, constructed to create a spark that would have, in fact, a radiation effect that would create the first radio waves. And in fact, they came to be known as Hertzian waves. Well, this was introduced in the mid-1880s, and people thought, wow, this is pretty incredible. We actually have these waves, and we can actually detect them. Maybe we can do something with them, people asked. Well, a couple of examples of people who are doing that. On the left, you see a fellow who's not nearly as appreciated as he should be, a German by the name of Ferdinand Braun, who took Hertz's discovery, who began to devise more and more sophisticated equipment to figure out, well, now, can we, in fact, send these signals to a distance? Can we do something with them? Can we actually apply them? What kind of technical problem do we need to solve? The other figure here, the old man, and indeed he was, in fact, the old man of English physics at that day, was Oliver Lodge, who also had these ideas about maybe we can take the kind of radiation and do something useful with it. But these individuals did not quite push hard enough to make this into a real viable technology. And anybody who looks at this story knows that making that translation from science, from theory, even from demonstrated phenomena into real technology is an extra step. Many scientists, and both Brown and Lodge are scientists, could not take that extra step. So it took another individual, Guglielmo Marconi, who was not, in fact, a scientist, although he did, in fact, receive a Nobel Prize. But Marconi was an incredibly enthusiastic, smart, rich, and lucky, too, I might add, which helped amateur. And so he, in particular, what Marconi was doing was to say, I think that these Hertzian waves can be actually used for real, viable communication, that they can fill a need in the world, they can fill a gap somehow. And he took his mother's family wealth, and he applied it to the building of some stations, a large antenna. This is the antenna network that he set up on the coast of Cornwall, on the very southwestern tip of England. I might add, it's a nice picture. You've got a picture of this out in the exhibit out there. What the picture in the exhibit doesn't tell you, but I will tell you, was that a big windstorm came and blew this whole antenna array down, and it never did anybody any good. But it's a great picture, got to admit. Now, this is the mid-1890s, and Marconi is, in fact, beginning to achieve some success. And in 1901, particularly if you know your Canadian history, you're well aware of the fact that there he is sitting in St. John's, Newfoundland, and he received the first signal over the Atlantic Ocean by wireless. And the picture you have of Signor Marconi showed him at the St. John station with the receiving equipment. So that by 1901, the Marconi system, as it comes to be known, is beginning to be used, people beginning to come up with ways of actually applying it. The first application of his system was at sea, because that was the one place where you could not communicate. Even across the ocean by that time, we had cable communication. But ships at sea needed something else. The ship up there on the upper portion of the picture is, in fact, the first ship that was equipped with Marconi equipment around 1901. The other picture shows you the Marconi room of one of the most famous ships to be equipped with Marconi equipment, and that was the Titanic. Marconi did not stop, however, and of course the notion of radio communication did not stop with that. One history of radio communication, of course, goes off in a totally different direction, into radio broadcasting. And that's not what I'll treat here. What I'm looking at is how this begins to translate itself into the notion of mobile communication, of communication that, in fact, means that you're not necessarily rooted in one place. Marconi himself did not want to restrict himself to maritime communication, so we see in 1901 a Marconi experimental system, which again, I might add, did not work, partly because the antenna kept falling down. But it was at least an effort in 1901 to come up with some kind of mobile communication. Somewhat more successful with the experiment coming out of Bell Telephone Laboratories in 1924. We begin to see now the possibilities of some kind of mobile communication that will work. Now, at the same time, of course, we're getting the development of radio, broadcast radio, and the idea of making that mobile, too. By the late 1920s, it's beginning to catch on. You see the automobile radio, people begin to see that this is something that mobile communication is something that they are beginning to expect. By the late 1930s, this is beginning to translate into the proverbial black box. I love this picture because it is the black box. What it is the Motorola police cruiser. It is one of the first real mobile, practical mobile radio systems as police cars began to be equipped with the kind of two-way systems. Now, if we move into the 1940s, the technological background begins to change, and there are two crucial elements of this. The miniaturization of electronics, the kind of things that went into radio are now getting smaller and smaller and smaller, thanks to World War II, and of course, the introduction of the transistor in 1947-1948 provides us with a real technological breakthrough, allowing us to miniaturize and to reduce the power requirements. One other element of all of this is the introduction of the walkie-talkie during World War II. So again, the idea of some kind of mobile and wireless communication is beginning to catch on in a very real way. By the time we get to the 1970s, we now have the possibilities of the wireless telephone. People are beginning to explore the possibilities of taking the miniaturization technologies and the computer technologies that were developed during the 1950s and the 1960s, in fact, to produce the very first telephones. You can see they're very bulky equipment. They often require that you have a suitcase full of electronics to go along with you to be able to do it. But the idea by the 1970s is now being pursued until we finally get into the devices that we associate with wireless communication in the 1990s and in the 21st century. And now I think I've set the stage for a real inventor that will tell you how it's really done. Thank you.
Well, that was a whirlwind tour of technological and scientific breakthrough mixing together. But it's all true, and it really did happen. And a lot more happened than that. We don't have enough time to go into it in detail. Quite frankly, when I was asked to speak about this, it was a bit of an intimidating task because there's so much to talk about. One of the things that you're going to see as a recurring theme around what I do and what I believe in, and you sort of saw a little bit of that through the American Express ad. You know, my life is about making ideas happen. But this whole recurring theme of ideas and the power of ideas. Now, when I was at Control Data, I don't know if very many of you remember Control Data. There were a few supercomputer companies at the time in the 80s and before. There was IBM, there was Control Data, there was Unisys, there were a whole bunch of these large companies, digital. And one of the things I remember, because it was really inspiring for me, was that I worked with the two visionaries in that organization, the chief architecture designer and the chief microcode designer. And the chief microcode designer was the person who wrote software that made the hardware work. And then we ran the software on top of that. Now, they told me something that I never forgot. They said, "Mike, when we design computers and when you sit down and work with us, one of the things we want you to do is to sort of put away everything you know right now. and start predicting what will be available to you 5 and 10 years from now. So in fact, if you look at the documentation at the time for control data, when we talked about the future designs, we had 5-year cycles and 10-year cycles. I mean, things were a little slower back in the 80s. Now we think of 6 months, a year, 2 years at the most. But one of the things that was really exciting for me was that this idea that said, Mike, if you want to build something amazing, don't design with today's technology or today's tools. Try and predict what will be available for you 5 years from now and 10 years from now. What will be the tools that you will have available at your disposal to create the next generation computer? Now that stuck with me. And in fact, it's been something that I've tried to instill in our employees. And it's something that's worked really well. But now let's try and think a little bit about going back 100 years ago. You know, you take a look at what was described. We're talking about, you saw giant radio antennas. You saw, what we call spark gap transmitters, things that you don't even remember. You know, it's not something that we talk about except when we view history. What else happened back then? When we look back in that time, you see the beginnings of cars, the beginnings, the experiments of airplanes. People didn't have television. People didn't have radio. What is it that we remember about that time? Right? We think about it, we go back in history, and we see that we're using steam engines and horse and buggies. What's interesting about it is that 100 years later, we hardly remember the tools that they took for granted at the time. Hardly remember them. What is it that we're celebrating today? We're celebrating Einstein's miracle year. We're celebrating ideas because they've lasted. They've lasted 100 years, and they're more powerful now than they were when they were discovered. Do we remember steam engines? Do we see them? Do we see them going on the road, on the tracks? No. Do we see a lot of horse and buggies? Well, we live in a place where you see a few. But even propeller-driven airplanes are something that, you don't see very often. You see these white contrails in the sky that you know is an airplane because somebody told you it is. You know, we see space stations orbiting the Earth. We see laser communications. We see miniaturized devices that give you access to every piece of information in the world. That's something that really hit home when I used the BlackBerry to access Google for the first time. And I realized every piece of information in the entire history of mankind is available to me in seconds wherever I am. That's where we are today. And what's amazing about understanding a little bit of how history and science and technology works is to realize that what we take for granted right now, people won't remember 100 years from now. The technology of the day, they won't remember 100 years from now. They'll look at it quaintly in history books and say, well, gee, isn't that nice? What was that? How could they live like that? Think about it, though. It's hard to imagine this. It's hard to imagine. Put yourself 100 years from today and look back and say, everything that we take for granted, all the advances in our civilization, all our advances in education, all our technology, our computers, our fiber optics, our wireless communications, our 400 horsepower engines, everything, our fabrics, 100 years from now will be difficult to recognize unless a historian brings it up in a presentation projected on the wall. But what will be with us, what will continue to transform everything, will be the ideas and the discoveries made in basic science. Those things will last. They will continue. In fact, they get better with time. So there's this interesting relationship that we find. We find that in science, we tend to view the world through the technology of the day. I mean, you look up there, you see wooden antennas, you see giant metal boxes supporting things. Right? In fact, they were using steam engines to drive generators to power these radios. When we look at what happened in the 1900s, in the early 1900s, they viewed the world through what they could touch and understand at the time. They were just discovering photography. You know, photographs weren't even in newspapers yet. So they were viewing things through their eyes. They couldn't imagine a world that was more advanced than the one they had. And when they tried to imagine it, they viewed it through the filter of what they understood the technology of the day. And science was a little bit affected by that, because what was happening was the theories of the day were being tested with the equipment and technology of the day. And that's something that continues today. But it's an interesting cycle to understand. Because what was happening was the scientists and engineers were taking the best technology available to them, the highest precision technology and machinery available to them, and they were using that to test the established prevailing theory. And that's what was happening. They were getting better and better equipment, and they were able to see things and see interactions that their senses couldn't perceive. Right? We talked about light. Well, light's a tiny sliver in that electromagnetic spectrum. Tiny sliver. But it was the equipment of the day, the induction coils, the tuned circuits, that allowed us to see that there are other forms of there's either frequencies of electromagnetic radiation that was invisible to our senses. And that's a recurring theme. The technology of the day gives us the precision and the ability to measure those things that our senses can't, and to see things that our senses can't. And when that happens, we realize that our theories, our ideas from science, basic science, these ideas are limited by our understanding of what's around us, the technology around us. What's interesting is this amazing relationship between technology and basic science. That when you come up with new discoveries, when the tools, the technology of the day is capable of producing an experiment to test a theory at a higher precision level, we tend to find what is missing in our theory and in our understanding. We tend to find things that we can't explain. We tend to find interactions we don't understand. And it's that when we find that, that's what challenges the science of the day and it challenges the scientific thinkers of the day to either come up with brand new insights, the new theories, like the ones Einstein came up in his miracle year, but other ones to refine our ideas. Something like what you saw today with Maxwell's equations. And I'll get to that in a second. But what's interesting is this relationship. The technology of the day has been affected by the science of the past. That technology is then used to create much more precise experiments that challenges the theory and science of the past. When that happens, we usually find where the science and theory is inadequate. And that's when the scientists are challenged to improve, correct, or come up with something completely new when it comes to the theoretical base of our understanding of reality. When that happens, we get a technological shift. That technological shift affects everything about our lives. It affects how we dress. It affects how we communicate. It affects how we get around. It affects how healthy we are. It affects everything that we take for granted at our slice in history, where we are today. And this continues. Those new theories predict new effects. The new effects need to be tested. That pushes our state of the art. Those theories predict new processes, new materials, new techniques that produce new industries. Those new industries produce new technology, which is more precise. And it's always that way. It's always more precise. Precision goes up. Repeatability goes up. Efficiency goes up. Those are used to test the theory of the day. Those theories then need to be changed when we find the errors or omissions in our understanding. That's really important because that's what drives progress It's that direct link between technology and basic science discoveries. Now, why do I say this? You know, this is important because we need to understand why it's so important to invest in basic science. Now, let's go back a little bit to the original thing that I said. When you're working today, in my walk of life, in engineering and technology development, it's very important to put yourself in the future and say, what tools will I have? What will be used at that time? What will be prevalent at that time? And I'll tell you something, one of the great things about universities is that the university students have an opportunity to be exposed to ideas and techniques and technology that really isn't going to catch on for another decade or more. What's interesting is when you're in university, and I can tell you that, and if there's anyone here that's in university right now, when I was in university, I took that for granted. I took for granted that I was playing around with technology that wasn't going to catch on for 10 to 20 years after I graduated. What was that technology that I was playing with? Networks? Email. Sound familiar? Okay. When I was in university, networks were a research project. Email was something that I had to learn to use so I could do my assignments and I can communicate with my colleagues on group experiments. It was something brand new to me, but I took it for granted. It was just a tool. Little did I know that 20 years from now, you know, email would not only be indispensable, but you know, it would be sort of the next generation of spam that we all know and love. So just when I was able to stop the junk mail going to my physical mailbox, it now pours into my virtual mailbox. But what was important about that was that when I was in university, I was exposed to things that I took for granted that 10, 20 years from later were absolutely instrumental. Now, the same thing happened when I was in high school. In high school, I had the good fortune of having an electronics teacher that was the president of the local amateur television club, very similar to the amateur radio, but at the time, you know, things had progressed to the point where we were sending moving pictures with wireless. But again, took it for granted. It just was there. It was an opportunity. It was exciting. It was cool. But it was, to me, I took it for granted as, wow, everyone should know this. This should be common knowledge. But it took many years later for me to realize that this was cutting edge. This was new. This wasn't going to catch on for another decade or two. And of course, putting all those pieces together allowed me, through entrepreneurship, to produce the BlackBerry and Research in Motion and the success that followed that. And of course, the tools, the resources to put back into investments in basic science, represented by Perimeter Institute and Institute for Quantum Computing. Now, again, let's go back and take a look at this cycle. Technology and basic science, absolutely related. It's hard to predict the future events, but you know what's going to change them. Scientific discovery is going to change them. You also know what's going to affect scientific discovery, the precision of the technology of the day. And you can learn from that. You can count on it because it's a fact that works, and it's worked for quite a long time. But let's go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. And let's put ourselves what was going on. I'm going to give you a little bit of insight in what I've studied. And it's not important that you remember who did all this. It's important the process. Because remember, who did it, and the tools you used to do it, and the technology of the day is irrelevant. What's important is the process that happened, because that's the constant, the process of ideas, and how ideas are created, and how they're tested. So back then, when you saw that they discovered this relationship between electricity and magnetism, which later on we discovered is the same thing. But there was a relationship, and Maxwell came up with some equations, and I'm not going to go into them. What I can tell you that's interesting about those equations is that when he solved for the equations, he came up with a prediction. The math predicted something. Now, you know, you think about that for a second. Mathematics, a bunch of numbers and their relationships, we use that to model physical phenomena of the day, and the math starts to predict something. It says there's a wave equation. There's something that's electromagnetic in nature that should propagate. Of course, it's just theory. I mean, why believe it? It's just a bunch of numbers. And yet, there were experimental physicists, that went out and tested it. And they discovered that not only was it correct, but those waves existed in physical reality. So let's fast forward a little bit. Of course, that led to all the entrepreneurship that led to the technology and success of radio, whether it's mobile or fixed, Marconi and others, that took that understanding and appreciated it and then commercialized it. But let's go a little further. Other discoveries that we had. When Einstein discovered that energy and matter are related, and in fact can be described as the same thing, very complex theory, very complex mathematics. He reduced it down to a simple equation, E equals MC squared, kind of, you know, put it there and kept on with his work. E equals MC squared. That was the reduction of the solution, or particular solution to his equations. What did it predict? E equals MC squared. It seems almost innocuous, simple. Well, first of all, C is the speed of light. And in the kind of terms that we use in engineering, you know, you'd think of it as meters per second. Well, that's C would be 300 million meters per second squared. 300 million squared. Imagine if that was your bank account. Right? I mean, it's unheard of as a number. It's hard for us to grasp that number and what it means. It really is hard. But it's huge. And it's multiplied by mass. The mass of what it is, that showed us that the energy that's in matter was tremendous, right? Energy equals mass times the velocity of light squared in meters per second. It's huge. So it's a prediction. Now, do we believe the math? Think about it. You know, he wrote that equation from trying to figure out, you know, how light behaves. He came up, his equations predicted an enormous energy, unthinkable amount of energy, caught up in matter, if we could somehow release it. It was after that discovery that people started going, wait a second, there's a lot of energy in this matter, right? And they started looking into it, and they went back and looked at experiments they were doing with radioactive material, and they said, you know what? These experiments where we're getting enormous equivalent energies from the decay of these nuclear sources, these isotopes. The energy they're getting in their apparatus, when they first saw the energy, they thought it was experimental error. It couldn't be that high. It made no sense. But, you know, think about it. You're talking about single events, the decay of radioisotopes. And yet, the energy that they were measuring when they did their experiments was basically unimaginable. And it wasn't until they started putting that together with the prediction from E equals MC squared that they said, hold on, maybe these experiments are correct, and they are telling us the right information. That means there's tremendous energy in nuclear reactions. And of course, we all know where that led. But again, it was the math trying to describe physical phenomena that became important or relevant or measurable at the time that, in that process to model it, led to a mathematical prediction or result that basically predicted something about basic nature that we would never have, you know, figured out on our own. So again, we go a little further. And another famous physicist came up with, was doing some work, and I'm not going to go into it, but this is what's important is that while he was coming up with his own theory and calculations, It predicted a basic symmetry in matter. And in fact, the physicist came up with the term. He called it antimatter. So we'd never seen this. We had no reason to believe it was real or that it existed, and yet the mathematics predicted it. Mathematics that was used to explain and model the experiment and understanding of the time predicted antimatter. Now think of how bizarre that is at the time it was predicted. So the earlier part of the 1900s. And then years later, when we test it in our accelerators, we discover that antimatter does exist. It's real. Of course, you know, science fiction predicted it for years, but it was real. Again, it's that cycle, technology, science, basically leapfrogging each other, but totally connected. And then there's this mystery of the mathematics that's used at the core, the base core tool that allows us to understand and describe physical reality. And that mathematics seems to be intimately related with reality in a way that we still don't fully appreciate or understand. And this continues on, and you can see this cycle happening. In fact, I was able to use, in Research in Motion, I was able to use mathematics, and I use it all the time. I'm famous for having a calculator on my desk. We use mathematics to make predictions about the technology that's available and the technology that's coming. And we use those mathematics to understand where we should invest resources and where we should go in the marketplace. And we know, because we really have a deep appreciation for the power of mathematics in that relationship, that it's a good and wise investment. And that's what allowed Research in Motion to grow, was this deep appreciation for the power of mathematics to predict not only the current phenomena, but future phenomena. And then to use that mathematics to make predictions as to where to invest. And you know, you can find this with the BlackBerry. One of the things that we discovered was that, you know, although Moore's Law, which is this idea that every 18 months to 2 years, the number of transistors you can pack into something, this is a very rough approximation, doubles. Although that applies to many things, it didn't apply to batteries. Battery technology has been very slow to develop. In fact, we found in our measurements that battery technology averaged about 6 to 8% increase in capacity every year. Nowhere near doubling every 2 years. So we predicted that batteries would not be able to keep up with Moore's Law in terms of technology, in terms of integrated technology and other forms of technology. And we spent an enormous amount of time improving the efficiency of the BlackBerry. And that's what gave us our famous battery life. But again, it was the power of mathematics and the trust that we had in that mathematics that allowed us to make these predictions that basically set the BlackBerry aside from all other technologies and made it famous. But when you think about it, you think about radio communications. And you know, let's think a little bit about radio communications. Radio communications were invented, what, 100 years ago? And even then, and when you read about the radio communications and what leading engineers and leading scientists thought at the time, what they thought about, you know, how did these radio waves, how were they produced? How could we make them efficient? How could we make them work better? What's interesting was that when you look at the papers from that era, some of their ideas were almost laughable. I'll give you an example. They believed that the spark that's produced from high voltage is what's producing the actual radiation of the wave, and that the antenna is just amplifying that. And of course, now you don't see sparks in any, you hope you don't see any sparks in BlackBerries. In fact, you know, the way it really was produced was this whole idea of the radiating alternating field. Now, the reason I'm bringing up wireless again in this idea of how technology and basic science are related, one of the things that intrigued me when I got into wireless was something that, you know, I'm sure a lot of you know about, but maybe you don't appreciate the significance of this. Do you remember in public school and high school, this idea of imaginary numbers? Do you remember I, right? imaginary numbers. Do you remember the square root of minus 1? I mean, think about how bizarre that is. What's the square root of minus 1? Right? So that, what it seems almost absurd, when my teachers, my math teachers, described, you know, the trigonometry behind imaginary numbers and how we could apply that to the understanding of wave phenomena. And then when I started to apply that in electronics, I realized something really amazing, is that those imaginary numbers predict an imaginary wave. So when you look at radio phenomena, you look at those waves, right? It's all just waves. Those waves are made up of two parts, a real component and an imaginary component. That's what the math predicted. In fact, there was a circuit that was invented that realized those two components. It's called a quadrature circuit. And it broke up. It was used to break up and recombine the imaginary and real pieces of a radio wave, of a signal. In fact, that's what led to the high data rates that we have today and the high spectral efficiencies that we enjoy today. Allows us to put, you know, digital, 100 digital channels in the same bandwidth as a single video channel, analog video channel we had in the past. This whole idea of quadrature, this whole idea of splitting the real and imaginary. Now, I want you to understand this. If there's anything that you're going to take away from today, it's this connection between what mathematics produces and how well it models reality, and the connection between the technology of the age and scientific discovery of the age. But think about this. When we produce a radio signal, in Marconi's time, they produced these solid chunks of energy, big sparks. And at the other end, what you heard were these clicks. You hear these kind of buzzing clicks, but basically clicks. And then you know, they came up with Morse code, and you could figure out what was being said based on that code, and decoding the code with your ear. In fact, at the time, the ear was the signal processor because there was so much static from lightning, which is equivalent to the spark transmitters that they had, that it was hard to tell the difference between the lightning that's going on all over the world and the actual signal you're trying to send and receive. And it was the human ear and its ability to perceive information that allowed them to actually hear and decode that signal, that Morse code, from all the background lightning noise that was going on. But other researchers at the time said, you know, we don't need to produce signals that mimic lightning. We should be able to produce signals that are unique. Why can't we take this mathematics that describes this behavior and use it to model different ways of communicating that are not representative in nature? In other words, there's no analogs in nature. There's no noise source in nature. So the first breakthrough was something called amplitude modulation. And what they did is they said, well, lightning is, you know, a big crack, produces a big widespread source of noise, and this is happening over and over again, and you're getting these crackles when you turn out a shortwave radio and you listen, tune in. That's that lightning noise that you're hearing all over the world. What they found out was they said, if we just send out a continuous tone, and then we increase the power when we want to produce a loud sound, we decrease the power when we want to produce a weaker sound, and we use that to produce information, to superimpose information on top of this continuous output sound, we're able to produce a signal that is much more rugged and can be much easier decoded at the other end. That was Amplitude Modulation. But the thing that really got me excited was a discovery that was made called FM Modulation. Now think about it. Up to that point, your radio is crackling and making all kinds of noise, and you know it's hard to tune in, and you really need a strong signal to really hear it well. A brilliant designer said, you know, one of the things about nature is that everything about nature is amplitude modulation. Crackles, loud, quiet, lots of energy, no energy. And this is happening all the time, producing this background of noise. One of the amazing thoughts was to take the math and say, what would happen if we, instead of amplitude modulating, we frequency modulate. In other words, we change the frequency to represent the signal. So instead of going this way, which is what nature does, we went this way. We went sideways. We went completely perpendicular to what nature does to produce noise. So you use a frequency shift to represent information. Lo and behold, we get FM, and all of a sudden it becomes quiet. Signal goes through clearly. You don't hear the background because there is no background. Nature doesn't produce FM. So again, we use the mathematics that we use to explain the information and science of the day. We use that as an engineering effort, and that's how technology progresses. We use that to predict and model technology that was able to overcome the noise of the time. And of course, that leads into quadrature, and that's something we use in digital communications, where we take not only the real, we take the imaginary components, we modulate them separately and differentially to each other. And that allows us to put enormous amounts of data into the signal. What's amazing is that we're literally modulating the imaginary math, the imaginary signal. You can't see it without the quadrature circuit, but the math perfectly describes it and predicts it. And then when we recombine those signals, we're able to send a signal that has enormous information density packed into it. So that's where we're at today. That's what we understand today. That's the technology used in BlackBerry and other technologies that are really pushing the envelope for communications. But what's interesting is that if history is to be believed, 100 years from now, everything we're doing today will be laughable when it comes to technology. The technology of the day, if it's even remembered at all, will be laughable. Whatever they have, we can't imagine. But the one constant will be the process they use for discovery, the process they use for testing discovery, and the process they use for innovation will be the same. And the ideas that are being discovered right now in basic science will be the ideas celebrated 100 years from today, just as we're doing that this week. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thank you very much, Robert. We have time for a few questions. I want to remind people before we start that there will be a Bistro Banter session starting in 55 minutes up in the Bistro that I will host with Mike and Robert and Jim Delgado as well, who gave such a stimulating talk on Arctic exploration earlier in the day. So we don't. I'd like to give our speakers an opportunity to get a glass of water and relax a little bit before they go on to their next event. So, but I do think we'll have time for two or three questions right now. So if you just put up your hand, we have people with microphones going up and down the aisles, and we will get your questions. There is a question for that gentleman in the white shirt right up midway.
First of all, thank you for the both speaker. Speakers about this enlightening talk, especially for my Lazar, it is about the relationship between the technology and the basic science. That it's the first time I hear it. My question is for Mike Lazar, it is considering your involvement in the activities of the Perimeter Institute and the Institute for the Quantum Computing that you're sponsoring. What do you think is the next technology shift that you were talking about before? If it can be made public.
So you want me to give away all my secrets, do you? Yeah. It shouldn't surprise you. It's no mystery. Quantum computing,
quantum cryptography, quantum communications, quantum control. Basically, what's happening right now is the same thing that happened around the turn of the century and the last century. The technology of the age had been perfected to a certain point, and we were sort of running into the limits of how far we could go. You saw those tubes in the previous presentation. You saw the big ones. Maybe you didn't see the little tiny flat tubes in that package that were sort of up there. They got to the point where they were able to put 6 tubes in one of those pieces of glass, those little tiny pieces, not the big ones. And they thought that was, you know, they're really pushing ahead. And quite frankly, you know, that was the distance they thought they could go. And everyone was investing in making tubes better, making them smaller, making them more reliable. Of course, the problem with tubes was that they did have a lifetime. And if you used a lot of tubes together in a computer, and you'd have to have tens of thousands of tubes in a computer, what's called the average mean time between failure got to the point where there was a tube failing every 15 minutes. So you couldn't run the computer longer than 15 minutes without having to go somewhere and find the tube that failed and replace it. That's why semiconductors were so important. But what was important was they were nearing this limit, and they thought they had to invest tons more money into making the tubes more reliable and smaller and less power consumptive. And I met the person who was working in that area at the time. And he told me that one of the big discoveries for him was he spent his entire life trying to make make tubes better and lower the noise that the tubes were producing. Because tubes had this funny thing where outside the tube was room temperature with air, inside the tube was a vacuum at very high temperature. And the materials that worked better in those two environments were different. So they had to combine them, and they had to crimp them together. And those joints where they crimped them were producing noise. And his job was to get rid of that noise, figure out a way, because that noise limited how loud you could amplify and limited how sensitive you could make amplifiers and receivers. And it turned out that when they did more and more research, and he did more research, he discovered that the limit he could go was limited by a semiconductor effect. Right? It was a semiconductor effect. And he spent his life trying to get rid of the semiconductor effect. Right? And in fact, the semiconductor effect is what we discovered makes transistors work, and we got rid of tubes. Right? And of course, everything we take for granted today. What's interesting is we're making these transistors. Remember I said Moore's Law? Moore's Law is getting smaller all the time. Well, we're able to put twice as many transistors onto our computers every 2 years. The reason we're able to do that is we make things smaller. The geometries of the parts get smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to sit down and write the graph of how small these things are getting, and realizing that within the next 20 years, the size of a transistor will be a single atom. We can't go any further than that. In fact, we're going to spend the next 10 to 20 years figuring out ways of getting rid of the quantum mechanical effects that are limiting computing and amplification at those sizes. Sound familiar? So that's my best prediction I can give you. You know, basically, what it is we're trying to get rid of and control is probably going to be at the foundation of the next generation of technology.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike, for this. We have time for one more question. I believe there's somebody here. Just as an aside, Mike mentioned rocket scientists, so I know quite a few rocket scientists. And just be aware, not all of them are rocket scientists, and that's...
In the history of the sending transatlantic messages, what happened to Nikola Tesla? Wasn't he the first person to actually send a signal, but he didn't get the patent?
What happened to Nikola Tesla? Oh, my. When I worked at the Smithsonian, we had a little special Tesla box for questions like that.
Nikola Tesla, actually I was talking to someone a bit earlier. Nikola Tesla, for those of you who don't know, was an absolutely brilliant inventor who came from out of Central Europe. He immigrated to the United States as a young man. He walked into Thomas Edison's laboratory, in fact, decided that the atmosphere was just too stifling there, and he sort of struck off on his own. He had a whole set of brilliant ideas. And actually there's a very important lesson here. I think we have a wonderful testimony to the significance of personality in successful invention. Tesla had an absolutely miserable personality. and that will get in your way. I think that's probably the best answer I can give you.
Thank you very much, Robert. At this time, I'd like to thank both of our speakers again for a very stimulating and informative tag team talk. Thank you both very much. Please feel free to join us afterwards for American Express Bistro Banter up in the bistro in 45 minutes. Please exit by the top right staircase. Thank you all very much for coming, and I hope to see you during the rest of the festival. Oh, no, don't do that.